to the I Don't Know What I'm Doing, This Might Get Interesting podcast. Today, my guest is Ashley Lee. Ashley is a mother of four boys and has been rearing young men for more than two decades. As a stay-at-home mother, she is also a homeschool educator of some success. Through her efforts, her oldest son was able to graduate early from high school and college with a degree in computer science. She has another teenage son, who is about to complete his bachelor's degree, and her other two sons are on a similar path. The academic success of these boys is only thrown into relief by their stalwart and impressive character, due largely to the dedicated upbringing by their parents, and their mother in particular.
One of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you on my podcast was because you are a mother of all boys, and I think that the boys that you are raising are turning into fine men in the world, and that in the world there is a significant and specific lack of good men. And maybe that's a debatable point, but I think it's important. So I kind of wanted to talk to you about boys and turning boys into men and what makes good men and things like that. But I guess, yeah, kind of what do you think has been your experience as far as raising boys? How has that been?
Well, it's been good. I the jury's still out. I feel like I have two that are, by definition, adults. One just turned 18 and one's 23. So I've got the two that are kind of like, I feel like I could not, I'm done with those ones, but kind of, you know. And then I've got the other two that I'm still raising, and one I think I'm a little bit behind on, my 9-year-old. So but it's been great. I do think I would have done things a little bit differently if I had girls, you know. I think there's some just off the top of my head, I think I'd probably be a little more compassionate in the way that I tell people to do stuff, or I think that I a little more no nonsense raising boys, because I think they have the same kind of, at least in our house, they don't seem to have the same response to Archer. they seem to be accepting of the no-nonsense approach, and, you know, the snapping the fingers to get things done, and the not really caring about feelings so much, or at least not considering feelings as much in some of the discussions that we have, especially if we don't have a lot of time and things need to get done. I notice with girls, and maybe it's just me, maybe it's just the way that I approach them, but I tend to be a little more careful, a little more like, hey, would it be okay with you if, with girls, but of course they're not my kids either. So anyway, I like raising boys.
Yeah, when it's not your kids, it's a whole different ballgame, no matter what.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So you've got a little bit over two decades of raising boys behind you now, right?
That's right. 23 years.
So how do you think, or has your methodology changed, or have your goals changed? Like, I look at my kids and if I think back over the time, I think, okay, not only would I have done some things maybe differently, but maybe I was aspiring to the wrong goals in the beginning.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. That's true a little bit for me too. I remember when I finally graduated from college, I had already had Remington, my oldest, and I feel like my mothering was a little bit on hold until I finally finished my own, until I finally finished college. He spent a lot of time with his grandma, he spent a lot of time with his aunt, and he was three when I finally finished college. And then I thought, like, okay, I've got that done. Now I'm ready to sink my teeth into this little guy. And I remember the term Renaissance man. And I remember from some humanities class that I had that, like, the term Renaissance man meant that you were kind of a jack of all trades. You were good at all these different things. And so in my mind back then, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have a concert piano. I mean, I thought of, like, the James Bond, the Itzhak Perlman. I had different ideas of what I wanted my boys to be like, and I want them to be this Renaissance man, really good at all these different things. And so I think I was sort of like outcome based at that time. Maybe I still am, but I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing. Let me just take one little aspect of that Renaissance man and talk about piano lessons for just a minute. I remember when I first, when we first started with that, I did a little bit of studio hopping until I found like the best piano teacher that I possibly could. And once we were there, I knew that she would be able to give us what we needed. And I knew that I for sure would not quit, meaning my boys would not quit. So I thought, you know what? We are going to get a concert pianist out of this. And that did not happen. But along the way, those 6 to 8 years of their life was in piano lessons with the right teacher. And then the home coach, which is what I considered myself, my responsibilities were to incentivize a lot of time, to build back up after their lesson, to just keep motivating and to keep going. She was a great teacher because she is Russian, very high expectations, very organized. In her studio, it was required that everybody would do one piano competition a year, at least two recitals a year, and also participate in this Arizona music study program, which was an adjudicated performance as well as a theory test. And so although we haven't turned out concert pianists, that experience they had in piano lessons was invaluable, because I think it's the tool that was able to help me help my boys develop grit. And there was a book a couple of years ago by this woman, Angela Duckworth, called Grit. And she defines grit as passion and sustained persistence applied toward long-term achievement with no particular concern for rewards or recognition along the way. We still have rewards and a little bit of recognition along the way, but just the, about 6 to 8 years of everybody's life so far, my oldest three anyway, they have had a constant pressure on them. There's always something they could be doing better. Not once did we go to a lesson and our teacher say, perfect, don't change a thing. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? There's always something she could find, especially towards the end. In May is when they would have their lesson when they would have their test for the Arizona Music Study Program. They had to have four pieces memorized, and that was the easy part. It's all the polishing. Our teacher had their songs memorized by about December, January. And after that, for the next 4 months, 5 months, it was polishing, polishing, polishing. These poor kids were so sick and tired of those pieces. And she could always find something. I mean, there's sometimes they were, they got progressively longer and longer, but we had 20-page pieces there towards the end for some of them. And I mean, every measure something could go wrong. So anyways, when they finished that test, it was always on a Friday. They would have a week until their next lesson, which was on a Friday. And that was pretty much the only week in the year where there wasn't something that they should be working on for piano, mm-hmm. And so my oldest son, Remington, spent 2 years on a mission for our church in Russia. And if you ask him today, he would rather do that again than go to piano lessons for another 2 years. And so I found that, whether it's sports or dance or something, some rigorous kind of training, that you do not quit and that you're constantly sort of trying to reach for something that's just a little bit beyond your grasp, is really important, I think, in raising maybe all kids, but boys too, because you have to do hard things in life. And if you don't know how to do them, when you're young, I think that's probably the easiest time to try to develop grit.
Yeah.
Is when you're in your own home.
That's specifically one of the things I had here that I wanted to talk about, was doing hard things. Like, I know that your music program has been difficult. A mission in Russia is another difficult thing. I look back on my life and the difficult things that I have done, and the things in my life that have been worth remembering have been difficult trials of hardship. And I think the world today, I think there's specifically a parenting culture, not everybody, but there's a certain group of parenting culture, which is to prevent your children from encountering hard things. And I think that has been damaging and borne rotten fruit in our society. But what's your take on doing hard things.
Yeah, well, no, I think it is natural for like a parent to want to pad the fall, you know what I mean? To kind of like, you know, remove hardship, or, you know, you kind of like, oh, you have this newborn baby and you hope that they never have to experience anything hard in their life. But I don't know why that's maybe like that's our feeling brain. And what you really need to, when you're raising kids, is to have your thinking brain be in charge. I remember when my oldest one was young and we were either living with my parents or spending a lot of time around him, but he tripped and fell or something. And my instinct was to go up and coddle him and whatever. I mean, it was fine, but it was, you know, what you'll notice a lot of times with little kids, they do fall down and then there's no reaction until they look to their mom or dad. But if their mom is like, oh, honey, you poor thing,
yeah,
then they know to cry. Whereas if it's like, you're good, good job, hop up, you're doing fine. And I remember this one time when my oldest one fell down or something, my dad was in the room and I was about to just like, oh my goodness, just pick him up and just, you know, but my dad was like, don't do that. Just watch what happens. He's fine. He'll get up again. And he was fine. And I had to try to kind of remember that. And that's something that I started doing because that worked. And I remember also being at a, baby shower one time and everybody was going around and giving this new mom like one piece of advice. And one of the moms who had older kids, older than mine at the time, I remember her saying, you know, if you can say yes, do. She gave the example of kids playing on monkey bars or doing things that maybe we consider dangerous, you know, the helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
Maybe you were referring to that kind of thing before. But she's like, you know what, a broken bone is a lot easier to mend than broken confidence. And that is something that really stuck with me too early on. I'm glad that I heard that. And then since then I've read a few different books about raising boys. And one of the things that says in there is that I remember it saying that you have to be able to let your kids get stuck in the mud and for them to figure out a way to get out. You know what I mean? Yeah. Not too dangerous, but they need to have experiences where they don't just like look to mom real quick or look to mom to fix their problems, you know? And, so anyway, I can't remember what any question was. Sorry.
Oh, it was just, what was your take on hard things?
Oh yeah. No, I think it's important. I think the more you can encounter those when you're young too, in an environment, well, hey, if it really does go south, there is somebody who has your back, or there's somebody there to maybe not save you from it, but encourage you, you know, yeah, to tell you, you know what, you can do this. You can do it. Keep doing it. And I think if we're left up to our own devices, it's natural just to want to quit.
Yeah.
But if you do have sort of a cheerleader or a person who's encouraging you, and when you don't have the confidence, or maybe, you know, I think that's a really important part of parenting.
Yeah. And I think that I would go so far to say that difficult things are worth experiencing just for the sake of them being difficult. Like, yes, there is the confidence building of being able to accomplish difficult things, but to try something really difficult and fail, there's power in that as well. You know, I mean, it was tough and whatnot, but when you get through it, you're like, well, at least, I mean, I got through it. It didn't kill me.
Yeah, you know? That's true. Yeah. That's a revelation all on its own. Sometimes I think you probably learn more from failure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, anybody who has accomplished anything has failed at more other things.
Right.
You know, in life, there's far more failure than there is victory or accomplishment or whatever you want to call it. But it's the, you know, the victories count more. But yeah.
And they mean more after you failed a bunch of times. They mean more. I remember, this is another thing that part of our has kind of creeped into our culture in the last couple of decades, but just every kid gets a trophy kind of.
What a bunch of hot garbage that idea is.
I know. I
can say nothing good about a participation trophy.
Oh, it just robs you of the victory, of the feeling of victory when you actually do win something. And I remember when the boys were younger, we signed them up for this wrestling camp. They were young, inexperienced, beginners and stuff. It was just this little summer camp at the local high school. And at the end of the week, they learned, you know, the first 4 days were learning different things about wrestling and practice. And then the last day was actual matches and stuff. And so everybody got to participate in one match. There was two people involved, one winner and one loser. And both my kids, I think they lost these ones. And which is fine. I mean, they were beginners. It didn't mean anything about their identity. But anyway, when we got home, they both had the red ribbon. The blue ribbon was, the winner got the blue ribbon and the loser got a red ribbon. And when we came home, I stood by the trash can and I just told my boys, I'm like, these are meaningless. You did lose. And that's okay. That's fine. I mean, that doesn't mean you're any less of a person. It doesn't mean that God loves you any less. It doesn't mean anything, but you actually did lose. I want you to be able to, someday you're going to win. And I want that to mean something to you. So we are going to throw these ones in the trash right now. It was nice. Those people thought you needed to have that, but I know better. You don't need that. You know, you lost and you don't, and that's okay. You can take that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Someday you're going to win and you're going to want it to feel good. So we're going to get rid of these ones right now. And someday you're going to earn it and you're going to love the way that feels.
Yeah. It's okay to lose. It is neither okay to relish in it or celebrate it.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, but I agree. And they've since gone on to win many a thing.
Yeah, they have won stuff and it feels really good. And I am so glad that they had the experience of, you know, sometimes when things don't come easy, like piano, and I didn't mean to say, I know some of my boys might be listening to this, they are proficient. They have learned, they can sit down, they can play anything they want to, you know? And they got a lot out of that, but even if they never touch the piano again, the life lessons of just keeping going when you wanted to quit every single year are transferable to so many other things, including wrestling. My boy that's 18 and made it to the state finals, which turned out to be the runner-up to the champion of the state finals. I mean, his freshman and sophomore year were rough, and he didn't want to quit, and he wasn't on varsity, and he didn't get very many matches, and yet he felt like he was doing everything he could with getting extra training and going to camps and all these different things, and it was, like, not immediate. The rewards took a long time, but they did come, and boy, did they mean a lot to the whole family, because we'd seen what he'd been through. Whereas if it had just come easy to him, the piano and all that stuff had just come easy to him, would have been worthless as a parenting tool you know.
Yeah, it's much more satisfying when you have to work for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on a slightly different angle, you know, talking about men and boys, Michelle and I had a conversation, I don't know, some time ago about a saying that she doesn't like, but which I think is a good saying, and it's man up.
Oh yeah. And
so she had taken a, you know, umbrage or offense to that statement that we tell boys to man up and what that means. And I guess, how do you feel about telling boys to man up?
Well, I love it, because I think what that means to me, and I'm sorry, because I do feel that there are, that the genders are different. And I do feel that part of the responsibility of men, of boys, when you give birth to a boy that you know someday, his number one main responsibilities will be to provide and to protect. And so when I think of the phrase man up, what that means to me is you take 100% responsibility right now. You start, you don't blame, you don't make excuses, you don't rationalize, you don't hide from or abandon responsibility. But man up means take 100% responsibility. And I'm okay with the gender assignation. I'm okay with that. I think there's a lot of things that a lot of natural gifts that women have, and they're different and just as important. And so I don't have any problem with that. But
okay,
yeah. But I like that statement. I think it's good, and I think it can be effective if a young man hears that and if it conjures in his mind various manly role models of men of integrity, mm-hmm. then I think motivating, encouraging to do what they've seen modeled. You know what I mean? Just kind of like, yeah, you know what? you're right, I'm sniveling. I'm going to forget that. I'm moving forward. I'm going to man up.
Mm-hmm. So what about toxic masculinity then? We hear a lot about that in culture. Well, I mean, we've apparently moved on to that. I mean, right now it's racism and whatever else.
Right. But
for a while there, it was toxic masculinity was the buzzword in all of the social world. And yeah.
Well, that term always leads me to a discussion of, you know, what is women's role in it? And I think that, you know, nowadays women should be able to wear whatever they want, have as much alcohol as they like, invite a man back to their bedroom, and still have 24 hours to decide whether or not they were raped after an encounter. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there needs to be that one of the antidotes to toxic masculinity is to have virtuous women model virtuous behavior. And it's not all on them, of course. And I teach my boys too about, you know, chastity and law and morality and all that kind of thing. But I know that not everybody has the same, religious tenets, yeah, or standards that they follow and stuff. But I think that the natural man is a sexual opportunistic person. And so, again, it comes back to that being 100% responsible. You know, both genders need to be 100% responsible when it comes to people being taken advantage of. I don't know.
So one thing you mentioned, this... So we've had this cultural wave, you know, since the 60s, the sexual revolution, women have become more liberal and free, especially with sexuality and whatnot. And, you know, I mean, today, monogamy, marriage, these sort of ideas are very, like, old school and almost shunned. Certainly, you know, like, long-term monogamous relationships that seem to be sort of quaint or something in the world. So what do you do as a mother of boys to prepare them to be men of integrity in such a world?
Right. Well,
or I mean, does that come into play into your parenting scheme?
Yeah. Well, you know, fortunately, I've just taken this for granted, but we have a little booklet called For the Strength of the Youth that you're familiar with, and it has standards that we believe the Lord has set. And so part of those are, you know, if there's someone dating, sexual purity. And I've raised my boys with the idea that sexual powers of procreation should only be used between a couple, man and woman, who are legally married as husband and wife. And so that's it. There's no that. And so that's kind of the gold standard. And we've kind of followed what the standards are in this book, where you don't date until you're 16. When you're 16, you go on group dates. I told my boys, you know, just expanded on that with just being alone after dark, you know, different things. But the expectation in our household is that when it comes that they will remain sexually pure, mm-hmm. And that's okay until they are married. And also, we talk about pornography all the time. And we talk about how why you don't engage in pornography. We talk about how it is not compatible with a loving relationship later on. We talk about how you can develop attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs about sex that are not compatible with, like I say, a loving relationship. What you see a lot of times in pornography is women are objectified. There's a lot of selfishness. Violence and those kinds of things. And how, you know, we talk about how when you get married to somebody, you both want to have the right idea about how wonderful this aspect of your relationship can be. And if it's skewed by things you've seen or viewed or whatever, so they all agree this is bad, they don't want to do it. But I do understand that they're boys. They can't help. Just like if you jangle a shiny set of keys in front of a baby, they're going to react.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have developed, we've got this book that we have used since, because we're younger, about, it's supposed to what do they call it? Like inoculate your kids against pornography, but it has like the spice. As soon as you see it, what they're trained what to do. They tell their mom, they say it out loud. There's different things we've done. So we've had to really tackle pornography. And I think that we are teaching our boys to respect women. I know in the wrestling world, this subject came up with my boys, because sometimes luckily my heavier weight, there haven't been a lot of girls in his weight class, but he did decide early on for him, he wasn't going to do it. And there weren't a lot of opportunities where he had to, but there was.
He wasn't going
to
wrestle a girl, you mean?
He was not going to wrestle a girl, sorry. And one of his coaches had a big problem with that. Just in practices and stuff. It wasn't a meet where his, like, he had to decide if he was going to be able to just to get disqualified for not doing it or go for the gold, you know, and nothing ever came down to that. But I said, you know, trying to physically dominate a woman, it's not right. There's just something that didn't feel right about it. He agreed. He's the one that said that. You know, I think too, with me being the only female in the household, it's really important for me to model virtuous behavior, for me to, you know, not get maybe lax about how they should treat women. You know, maybe I have been a little bit, just in terms of, like, you know, it used to be when a woman walked in the room, people would stand up. Yeah. Or you used to hear the phrase, oh, don't say that, there's a lady in the room. But women nowadays have, you know, just they use all the same kind of language as a sailor. And so, you know, what's the point then? Maybe if you don't have, if there's women out there that don't care, you know what I mean? Or if that's the general rule, I think what we have is a lot of women who think that in order to be equal to men, you have to be the same as men. So they've taken on bad habits or just things that used to be considered unladylike. But I don't think that the goal now for young women is to look really sexy and be able to use that as a powerful tool. Not to be, you know, ladylike and a June Cleaver type of person, which I still can see the huge value in the June Cleavers in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like such an advantage for children to have a mother's domestic presence at home when they're, you know, growing up. So anyway, I've told my boys to look for that. And I've got, you know, one that is like in that marriage.
In the zone. Kind of,
yeah, it's probably going to be the next big milestone for him, maybe. You know, he's graduated from college, he's on a mission, and it's kind of like the next big thing. But I'm like, you want somebody who knows how to bake. or can learn, is willing to learn. You want somebody who values, I think you want somebody who values the nurturing role that she, you know, can play. So, I mean, I'm not saying you want somebody educated, you want somebody confident, you want somebody who knows how to do stuff, who's, you know, independent and all that. But,
So, I mean, to your point there, you are, you know, by education, an engineer, you know, you are educated, yet you are you are educated and you are a homemaker. Michelle, my wife, also, as you know, is, you know, she's got a college degree and she's a stay-at-home mom and a homeschool educator, which you are as well. So I mean, it's saying that speaking to the importance of mothers in the home, I think does not mean that having an education or a, you know, a college degree or a marketable skill or whatnot is not useful to a stay-at-home mom.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree. It absolutely is. But I just, the one thing that the world doesn't tell you, and maybe one thing that I've even been surprised by, is that how much satisfaction I get out of being a homemaker, like a professional. I call myself a full-time homemaker. Like, when your household is running like a well-oiled machine, and you know, some of those things that can maybe seem mundane but cleanliness and food on the table and those kinds of things that brings daily joy to people, you know, and maybe they take it for granted. Maybe they don't know it, but when mom leaves for a week and comes back, you know it. But I remember having all kinds of like professional ambitions when I was younger, and I could just imagine myself on the Supreme Court or carrying a briefcase as I traveled through the airport, or, you know, all these different ideas that I had of what would make me happy. But I know people, like, when it comes to, like, lip service, they're like, oh yeah, stay-at-home mom, hardest job in the world, yeah, yeah, yeah. But what else do you do? You know what I mean? And so, but I, the older I get, the more I feel like I've really made a difference here. Like, I feel like, I mean, when my kids have any success in life, I actually have to hold myself a little bit responsible, because
oh, yeah.
I know that I, you know what I mean? Like, I take that on myself. I may not have a wrestling medal, but a little part of me is in each one of those things. You know, I'm so satisfied by what I do. I love it. I get so much pleasure out of it. I'm surprised.
And that reminds me of, you know, the Boy Scout program when, you know, they have the mom's pin.
Oh, yes.
For
yeah,
every
right.
one of those rank advancements, because they, I mean.
They know.
They know that these young men, as fine as they are not getting it done on their own, and that the mom is there doing a significant amount of labor in their achievements.
Yeah.
So you said something I found interesting. You said, you know, since you're the only woman in the house, you need to be setting, you know, an example or whatnot, which to, so I'm the only man in my house. And I was like, well, I wonder, am I, you know, showing the right example that I need to be, you know, showing my girls what a good man is or whatnot. So I'll have to think on that a little bit now.
Oh yeah. I bet you are.
The thing is how I represent half of the human race. And
that's right. No pressure.
In my home. But, so you've already spoken that you believe in gender roles.
Yeah.
Talk about June Cleaver and how that's probably she's a role model that has been lost to time, given our new culture and society. But I guess, what do you do to prepare? One of the things that Michelle and I have been talking about in all of this crazy upheaval and whatnot going on in the world, especially with, you know, racism and a bunch of other things. And I keep telling her, you know, everybody's talking about the wrong thing. The problem that we have in society is the degradation of the nuclear family, the traditional mm-hmm. family, and mm-hmm. it being eroded is at the heart of all of these problems, like, you know, inner city crime, mm-hmm. Urban, you know, social issues with fatherless homes and all these things, just breeding more difficulty and struggle and strife and poverty and all these things. But I think it all comes back to the nuclear family and how in society we've been, you know, destroying that. And I guess, what do you think the importance of family is in society, and of the role of men in the family?
Yeah. Well, I think that, as I said before, you know, I do believe in gender roles. I think that inherent in our gender comes different strengths and maybe weaknesses, but I'll talk about the strengths right now. I was in a group that, because of the coronavirus, has been kind of disbanded for a while, but it was a group that was like sponsored by some religious freedom, other bigger like special interest group and stuff. It was just, it had all these different topics about the family. And I think it's associated with the Catholic Church, but anyways, it was a group of women from my neighborhood. We'd meet once a month. We'd read all these different articles and then kind of discuss them. As it turned out, we were all pretty like-minded and like-hearted. And so there wasn't any kind of, we all kind of agreed on the same thing. But one of the ones that we studied was the role of the male in the home. And I remember that one of the articles talked about how, like, you know, when the dad picks up a baby and wants to toss it in the air, and the mom's kind of standing back going like, oh, no, be careful, you know, kind of thing. And so, but it all, and how, like, when the dad comes home from work and talks to the kid, he doesn't talk in baby talk, like the mom does. Like, she, one of my friends mentioned how, like, for a long time, her daughter would ask for a drink of Wally or something like that. Her husband had no idea what she was talking about. But when he would get home and ask, and she's like, oh, she wants a drink of water. He's like, well, then why don't you just say water here? This is water. And she's like, yeah, why didn't I just say that? Because I let her get away with the kid get away with this baby talk. But that, you know, just, it gave a bunch of just anecdotal snippets about how dads are different than moms and how you need both, and how, and it's interesting because around the same time, also one of my other kids was doing some kind of paper for like an English 101. And I think it was about the custody laws changing because in the past, you know, if a parent gets divorced, 99% of the time the kids go to the mom, but how, you know, that's been changing. Some of the custody laws are changing, and dads want a bigger role and want to be favored. And so there's all this different evidence and factual things about how important the dad's role is. I mean, in terms of girls and boys, it's different the way that they suffer as a result of not having a dad in the home. Mm. But like for the girls, they're like, you know, a certain number of times more likely to be, you know, promiscuous. Also, their self-esteem. They talked a lot about self-worth, self-esteem, and depression, and suicide, and all these kinds of things by the lack of a father. And boys also were more likely to engage in risky behavior, whether it be drugs or sex or violence. And, you know, like an overwhelming number of boys, it seemed like a majority of boys drop out. They're great. In both cases, their grades are lower, and, you know, all these things for not having a dad in the home. So, I mean, usually if there is a parent missing, it is the dad. And so that's just a little bit of evidence of how important a father's role can be in their family. I mean, the kids suffer. It takes more than just one parent. As much as a single parent, as hard as they try, it's like you really can't make up for what both parents bring to the table. And I think that over the next several decades, we might see that more and more as the definition of a family has changed to include, I mean, same-sex parents, single parents, parents that aren't married. I saw one of my kids was taking a family, definition of family class as a, you know, like humanities thing a couple of semesters ago at ASU. And so all of the videos, like, there was these videos you have to watch and then like sum up or whatever, and like, not, I mean, all of the videos were showing in a happy light all these diverse variations of what a family can be. One of them had two dads and two moms. The dads were, you know, they were like a lesbian couple and a gay couple, but they lived in the same household and they shared children. They were their biological children, but they weren't the husband, yeah. The men and the women weren't gay. And so anyway, and I remember the woman saying, like, I mean, I just don't know how two parents do it. I mean, there's no way I could devote as much time to my job if I, you know, if it was just the two of us or there was not enough. I'm like, yes, sacrifice is an inherent part of being a parent, you know. But I mean, they interviewed people on the street, like, what do you think about, like, and all the people that they showed, everybody was just like, oh, I think it's fine. I mean, if they're not hurting anyone and if they're, you know. And it showed a child saying, like, I don't see what the difference is. Some people have a mom and a dad, and I have two moms. Or, I mean, they showed it in such a favorable light. And it's like, you know what? Time will tell. I mean, it's just really a relatively new idea. We need to get a couple of generations.
I would think that time has told. I mean, if there were a hierarchy of, well, one, you know, for success in America, the number one indicator of success is a two-parent home. Mm.
Okay, yes. So
above,
right,
everything else, coming, if you come from a two-parent home, you are farther on your way to success than any other measure out there. Now, so if there's a hierarchy of homes, you've got at the top, you know, the highest probability of, you know, a mother-father home, then I would think that a two-parent home, even if they are same-gendered or not married or whatever, having two people there in two different roles, you know, so you can have a caretaker in the home and a breadwinner, for lack of a better word, you know, providing a provider, I guess, a provider and a caretaker or something, you know, it's a, that would be better than than a single parent home. Or I mean, there's an advantage there.
And, I agree.
You know, statistically speaking, you know, in that fashion, that's better. It's not to say that there aren't, you know, real winners who grow up in single parent homes with either just a mother or just a father or whatever. But I, you know, I think in history we have seen that society has fared much better when the family was strong. You know, strong families build strong communities, build strong societies. And I think
there's no getting
that.
Away from it. Yeah.
And maybe this experiment, as you say, we have, you know, time will tell us something, but I don't think it's going to tell us that anything is better.
Right. Yeah. I'm positive that you're right. Yeah. And, yeah, just thinking about how that's happened, you know, how we got so far from the, again, like the 1950s sort of utopia that, you know, and then to where we are now. And I think you mentioned before the sexual revolution, you know, and I mean, I think that's really where that's really a start.
So I guess, so how do you, I guess, do you actively try and, you know, I guess prepare your boys for, you know, for parenthood or to become these men that the world needs? I think of myself and the interactions I have with my children, and every so often I'm like, I need to have a discussion with my daughters about this. And a lot of times it's like finance and, you know, making decisions, choosing, you know, a job or whatnot, you know, certain much more trivial things, but and it's like, I want to have a discussion and be like, hey, let's talk about this. And I find that with a 12-year-old girl, it doesn't often go as planned. But I mean, I do think about what are the characteristics that I think are important for a young woman to have and develop as she grows into a woman. You know, and try and work to instill those, but
Yeah, I feel like I've, as I mentioned before, I've kind of had in mind the idea that these guys are, they need to, their major contribution to the family, if everything is right and their wife is, you know, on board with, you know, maybe the staying at home or the caretaker role and stuff like that, they need to be able to provide for the family and protect. And I think that, I'll speak to the provide part first. And I mean, their whole life has been, so, you know, you mentioned before that I homeschool, and the whole idea behind that was as soon as I finished, finally, when I finished college, and finally, when my husband finished college, it's just like, gee whiz, there has got to be a better way. That was horrible, you know, and then we met a family who their kids were, they were able to get their degrees before they went on their mission, as is typical, you know, in our church. And then when they got back, they could just, you know, hit the ground running. Whether that was to go on to graduate school or whatever, that just appealed to me so much. I thought to myself, this is my gift to my future daughter-in-law. I will get them their bachelor's degree before they leave my house. When they leave the nest, they should be able to fly. You know what I mean? They should be able to be earn a living, because I chose their bachelor's degree, and at some point it had to be some form of engineering is what I've just is so far. Because back when I was, you know, because with a 4-year, if it's just a 4-year degree and that's all you have, then engineering is your way to go. Yeah. That's, you know, so that's what I decided, and that's what they've done so far. And so far it's worked out. But our oldest boy, he took a financial, provident living sort of a class, like a Dave Ramsey kind of a thing. and he's following that. So I feel pretty good about him. If he keeps on going, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, as far as like providing, I've told him he wants to marry I said, seriously dating somebody, she also needs to take that class. If you guys can just stay to that, you'll be good. But the protecting is another conversation that we've had. I think nowadays it's different than like getting out your gun and, you've got like some kind of homestead that you're protecting from some outside force or whatever. But I have noticed a lot of times with, content creators and social media, a lot of mommy bloggers, I've seen a lot of girls in swimsuits. I've seen a lot of girls in bikinis and come to find out their husbands are the ones that are take their pictures for them, when they're on vacation and all these different things. And they make a living off of this. You know what I mean? A lot of, and I mean, it really stands out to me, the immodesty by people who I know should have the same standards that we have. And I say, how in the world, how is this protecting the virtue of their wife? They're not only are they letting, the circumstances I'm talking about, they have said in their question and answer session, oh yeah, my husband is the photographer. He's learned a lot over the years and stuff like that. And it just blows my mind that a person who's supposed to be protecting your virtue, making a living off of it. And so that's a conversation I've had with my boys before too, just about how the protection aspect of being a man, and a father and a husband and stuff like that. So, I don't know. There's probably more ways of protecting and I've also talked to him about physical strength too. Like, you want to be able to, if somebody needs you to carry him upstairs or what, I don't know. We've talked about staying physical shape that way too. But I'm still new at this. I'm still, I only have two adult kids so far, so, but these are conversations that we have had.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So what does it mean to protect a mm-hmm. wife and family in the world today? Mm-hmm. That's an interesting mm-hmm. question. And then you said getting them all through college, getting them a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
You see that as the way to success?
Well, it's helpful because they're busy. I noticed that some of my friends who maybe, kids are having some trouble, and not just doing naughty stuff, but just they can't get them off the video games, or they're just like wasting their summer, especially this last few months. And kids, things have been closed. There haven't been as many opportunities to gather or to, things haven't been mm-hmm. open or whatever. I've seen a lot of, I'm hearing just, the few people I talk to, they're just like, their kids are so lazy or they're having to really they just don't have anything to do. And I will say that if you're trying to get your bachelor's degree in the same amount or relatively the same amount of time it takes most people to, go through the public school system and get their high school degree, there's not a lot of time for messing around. You know what I mean? And another mm-hmm. thing is that I've noticed, which I really love about this, is that there is, there's always something that we're like as a family praying for so-and-so to do good on his test or, cause it's hard. I mean, they're younger than all of their peers at school. And, I've kind of, and they've got, it's difficult, but, at their age and, sometimes I forget that they're younger than most of their peers or that they're, asked them to do more than their peers. But then when I remember, but it's been great because it keeps them humble. And it keeps them praying. And I think that they've been able to develop a relationship with God because they've been in situations where they really need help to achieve their goal of an A or a B, in a class. There's been some classes where just like, hey, we get a B in this one, we're going to call it good. But, they want to get A's and stuff. And so I think that trying to do that bachelor's degree before they're 19 is A, kept them really busy, and B, brought them to their knees many times. And so I feel like some of those hard things they've had to do, one of the best outcomes of that is helping develop a reliance on a higher power, on God,
Mm-hmm. So what would your thoughts be if one of your kids wanted to do like a vocation or a trade?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not opposed to that, especially because, I'm not opposed to that at all. If that's like where their talents lie, then you think of all the opportunity cost of time and money that would have been spent on college, and whereas they could just get right to it. If mm-hmm. they if they have some like the Dave Ramsey training, hey, have you ever taken that class? Do you are no. you familiar with that?
I mean, I am familiar with the seven steps, but not with.
Okay, yeah. When you follow those things, anybody can be wealthy. I mean, anybody can be wealthy if you at the beginning live like no one else. This is so that later you can live like no one else, you know? And so anyway, you can follow those steps. So when I say wealthy, it's just, again, go back to that. You got to be able to provide for family. You're not going to be a happy person in life if you have to say no all the time to your wife and your kids because you can't afford it. You know, you're not going to be, it's not going to make you feel good. And trades are great. I think we've got a friend that lives down the street who knows how to do, he's air conditioning, plumbing, electricity, heating, cooling, like all that mm-hmm. stuff. He's got a degree. He played college football. He's got a thriving business. His house is paid off here. He's got a cabin in New Mexico that's paid off. Yeah. I mean, he has a great life. And so, if my youngest one, you know, Sebastian, he's got some dyslexia and some hyperactivity. So trades may, I don't know. That might be a better option for him. We'll see. Still going to do my best to try to get him to.
That's one thing, you know, growing up in our home, I didn't realize that there was an option other than college.
Right. Yeah.
Like that was not that just never came into the realm of, oh, you don't go to college. Like I remember at graduation, you know, I told mom I didn't want to go to my high school graduation because I was like, this is pointless and dumb. You know, there's a speed bump on right. the road. I don't even know why we're pausing to take pictures. And, you know, then after I got out of college, I was like, you know, I could have done something else, but yeah.
Yeah, I know. You think of all that money and all that time when, man, 4 years later, after like nine months at a technical school or something, and you can be making real money, yeah. You know, and it won't be outsourced. And, and it's always needed. I mean, honestly, the trades are looking better and better.
Right now, trades look really good, but what I'm trying to get my kids interested in is computer science.
Yeah. Because
if you can learn to code and you can develop some apps or some software, mm-hmm. portfolio software, nobody cares if you have a degree or whatnot.
Right. It's still really the only field that's like that. Yeah, I mean, you're right.
Where the proof is in the pudding and
yeah.
whatnot, but yeah.
I know. That's why I kind of steered my second one into because of, you know, AI and just data collection, data mining, what you do with that information. It's like so valuable right now. So anyway, yeah, that's good. I think especially for women, right? I mean, especially for women. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, so I try and keep these at about an hour. We've gone about that far. So, yeah, I guess one question that I try and ask everybody who I've talked to is, if I can find it here. Basically, what is a small thing that you think would make a big difference in the world, you know, today? Or, you know, I guess, speaking of in the world of developing men of integrity or helping boys grow into men, what are some small changes that would have a big effect on our world?
Well, I think that this idea of taking 100% responsibility is gold dust. I mean, I don't have time to give you this anecdote about it, but I'll just give you one situation. As I look back, and it's not something I ever put into words before, but as I look back and I've seen it as practice, for example, when the boys are in school and they're oftentimes having to work in a group project, I tell them, you know what? It's nice that those other people help out, but at the end of the day, if you want an A, you just pretend that you're in this group by yourself. If you need to do it all, we'll do it all, because you know, you take your 100, if you leave it up to them, trust me, you're going to have at least one slacker, or you're going to have one. Or so that's an area where we kind of already had been doing. That's one small area we've been, mm-hmm. where I kind of been practicing taking 100% responsibility. But what you find when you do that is that your agency goes up. The more responsibility you take upon yourself, then the more freedom you have. And I think that, like, right now, especially like in the political climate and the blame game and all that kind of stuff, like, to say that like a certain race or group of people need other people to need demands to be met and reparations made or other things like that by other people takes away their own agency.
Yeah.
To be. So it's like, you want to take on, and especially if you take 100% responsibility, even when it's not fair, it's more, yeah. especially when it's not fair, that's when, you know what, you're in the driver's seat.
Yep.
And so I think you can apply that to a lot of things, both worldly and just, you know,
yeah, I just read a book this last week called Extreme Ownership. You may want to read that.
Yeah.
by a man named Jocko Willink, and that's his whole thing. If you take ownership of everything in your realm, you can get things done. And if you stop making excuses and mm-hmm. whatnot, mm-hmm. but I recommend that, and for your boys too to read. It's a good book.
Extreme Ownership. Okay, got it.
Yeah, it's Jocko is he's a former Navy SEAL, and he talks about the leadership principles that he learned in the SEAL teams, how it applies to business and life in general, and the book has some of his stories from some of his experiences in the SEAL teams. He uses those as the backdrop to teach the principles, so it's a pretty interesting read.
Thank you.
Yep. But, all right. All right. Well, thanks, Ashley, for talking with me, and I hope we can do this again sometime. I hope it was an enjoyable experience for you. I don't know what you were expecting with this, but
yes, thank you. I hope I didn't say anything that could get me in trouble.
Oh, if you say anything anymore, you're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So, all right. I'm going to take 100% responsibility for what I said. See how that goes for me. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ashley.
Okay. Bye.